everybody. Welcome once again to another fantastic episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. My name is Adam Homey. I am your host, and I am honored by your wise decision to tune in and invest in yourself today. Here at the Business Creators Radio Show, we help you win at the game of business and of marketing so you can thrive from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion and make a difference for your community, market, and audience. Please take a moment, visit our website at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. You will find hundreds of episodes covering a breadth and depth of topics relevant to you as a business creator and links to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. And now let's get started with what we're going to cover here today, which is a topic that in my work through the Business Creators Institute and throughout the pages of my book, Groundhog Day is an Event, Not a Business Strategy, there are a couple key themes, one of which is the application of minimalist principles to achieve maximum results. Another is how we can subtly alter our language to increase the value of our communications and, likewise, get greater results from our efforts. Throughout all of it, and throughout my experiences over 20 years, as either somebody who for the first few years worked in a corporate setting and for the past 17 years has led an entrepreneurial venture, I've discovered in so many different ways from so many different angles the value of putting people first. And we have somebody with us today who has some incredible insights on this. And I am so looking forward to introducing him to you today. I'm gonna introduce him and I'm gonna tell you a little bit about him. His name is John Fairclough, and he is the founder of the Resicom Group. And let me tell you about that. The Resicom Group helps retailers optimize the way they improve and maintain their store environment. Under John's leadership, the company has evolved from a local construction company into an international provider of facility maintenance and construction services. And now, John enjoys sharing his stories. He's going to share it with you today to inspire others. So John is one of those people, and this is one of the things I love about him. He leans on his faith to help him persevere through the difficulties of overcoming the status quo. Oh, I like it. He values people and understands the balance needed between the strength and consistency of process and the value of personal dignity. See, I never quite heard it worded that way before, so I'm very intrigued to get into that. He relishes the oxymoronic tone to solutions. I like that too. What people quickly discard is often the best course of action. John Fairclough's best virtues were incubated by extreme poverty and forged through his unlikely business success. Humility and justice are the invisible strains of his diverse and adverse experiences. Naturally, people come first for him. And finding a way to see their good, wanting them to obtain their missing good, and staying hopeful for them are the things he works very intentionally on. So, John Fairclough, come on in. The weather's fine.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so happy to have you here. Now, I gave a little bit of your background here, but what we like to do is, by this point, we have listeners who are sort of leaning in, and they have a separate browser tab open, and they're binging the Yahoo out of the Googles, discovering more about this John Fairclough. That's spelled F-A-I-R-C-L-O-U-G-H. You're welcome. And this Resicom Online, or Resicom Online, which is R-E-S-I-C-O-M-O-N-L-I-N-E.com. Resicom Online. So as you are exploring more about him, what we want to do, John, is if you could tell us, above and beyond your official biography, tell us a little bit about some of the drivers in your personal journey that have brought you to where you are today, serving business creators from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion and making a difference for your community, market, and audience.
Well, I like to do great work, and I like the harder the work is, the more I like it. There's something about intense things that other people fail on that I just gravitate towards. And it's tough to do difficult things without having other people involved. Otherwise, they're really not that tough. Maybe it's tough for a person, but when you take on some big challenges that involve a bunch of moving parts and things, getting a team together to go out there and accomplish it, man, I love that stuff.
Right. So my first question to you, and I want to go back to what you shared with us a few moments ago in your bio. you mentioned that there is a balance needed between the strength and consistency of process and the value of personal dignity. This is an area where I myself spend a lot of time, but I'd like to hear you elaborate upon that so that our listeners can understand it practically.
Well, we're people first, and a lot of people kind of forget that. And, you know, if we were made to just auto-reply to things, we'd be computers, but we're not. You know, we're people, and we've got discernment. We've got the ability to reason and other things. And so a lot of times people get comfortable in that they have addressed a situation, like whether they thought about it and solved it, or they've established a process and given that to a team to do. And in their minds, it's done because the process was written. But really, that's not the challenge. It's the real objective is to get another human being to do the things that we need them to do to satisfy a client or whatever the case might be. Right. And so if we stay, you know, if we only fall in love with the process and we forget about the person, it's tough to get their all. And the more we can get out of the person, the more engaged and involved or committed to the real objective, the better off we're going to be. So I a lot of companies load up with rules. I think that rules are more like tools. Maybe like a simple example would be the Ten Commandments. We could look at them as being rules, like you must do this, you must do that, or we could say it's a tool. If you want to have a good life, you probably don't want to violate any of the Ten Commandments. Probably going to live a better life that way. So it's, you know, is it a rule or is it a tool? Really trying to lighten the load on people for them to be successful.
You know what I've found over the years is that so many of these roles, regulations, prohibitions, prescriptions, spelled prescription, that we find in organizations that govern people's behavior, what they're supposed to do and what are not supposed they're not supposed to do, are permanent overreactions to minor temporary issues.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I love to tell this story, and you may have heard this before. In fact, in your line of work, you probably have. So there was a man who asked his wife why, when she put the roast in the pan to roast it, would cut off the ends of it. And she said, well, my mother told me that it made the roast juicier and it brought out the flavor, so it makes for a better roast. So the guy was curious, and he went to his mother-in-law, and he asked her why she told his wife to cut off the ends of the roast. And she said, well, you know, as they said in the old country, when you cut off the ends, it lets in the flavor, it makes the roast juicier, and it makes for a better roast. And that was handed down to me from my mother and from her mother and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the grandmother-in-law was still alive, and they were over the grandmother-in-law's house for Thanksgiving. And the husband remembered to ask his grandmother-in-law why they cut the ends off the roast and why this was a family tradition. And the grandmother-in-law said, look, during the Depression, we didn't have a big pot. So I had to cut off the ends so it would fit in the pot. The point being is we not only forget the origins of why we do things sometimes, but we create these, or we see created these grandiose explanations and reasons where the actual catalyst was often nothing more than an expedience. The reason they cut the ends off the roast is because they didn't have a big enough pan and couldn't afford to buy a bigger one. So it became this whole thing about how it improved the quality of it, which was not actually the case.
Yeah, I that's a cute story. I know there's so many examples of things like that. Today we're having a meeting, and one of the challenges that one of my key people was having was related to data. He wanted to have some information as to how many proposals that we submit are done within 48 hours. And that's an internal goal. It has nothing to do with our client's request on it. It's just something that the faster we propose it, the better position we are in to acquire the business. And
of course.
And so there was just like this kind of debate going on, and they wanted to have a percentage. And so I just simply asked, well, does it matter if it's accurate? And automatically, well, yeah, I mean, why would we want to look at something that's not accurate and all of that? And through the conversation, I kept kind of poking at this, like, does it have to be accurate? And it sounded kind of silly to the team. And then in the end, when we got to the spot, is that everyone recognized that this item was simply directional. And if we try to, really the important item for us is how many bids can we submit the same day? And if I can get the team focused on taking care of the same day ones and manage those super closely, then anything that did not get done in the same day then falls into this a category of wanting to be done within 2 days, and those are easier to monitor. So the percentage being precise, though it makes logical sense, and if I was to say to you, well, would you rather have accurate information or inaccurate information, you know, everyone would pick accurate. But if the question was, would it be acceptable if I gave you enough information for you to make the right decision? And that's really the only burden. So I don't need to make sure it's precise, and I don't need to do all this labor intense work to find out what that true number is. I just need to give a direction, and with that direction, we're going to be able to get the outcome that we want without burdening it with all process and all these other things that go along with it. Though this might be a hard to grasp concept, a lot of things really don't need precision. You need, if you want to be successful, figure out what needs to be precise and make sure that's precise, but don't make everything precise. You just don't get the bang for the time.
Yeah, I've discovered working with digital marketing agencies, some of the ones who've worked with some of my consulting clients, especially the really good ones, will put multiple tracking softwares on a landing page or multiple tracking cookies inside an email, whatever it is they're looking to track, whatever funnel they're following. And I got to where I began to ask them, right? So we have Google Analytics, we have Woopra, we have the Facebook Pixel, and we have a couple other things. Is it possible that we're using all of these different codes simply because no matter how accurate you think something is, all five of these softwares are going to give you a different answer, and you're simply looking for an average that gives you a general idea so that you know what you're doing overall? And they said, exactly, you get it. There is no such thing as precision when it comes to this, because all the tracking softwares deliver different data off the same platform.
You know, it's funny because the objective, like with the bids, we go back to, you know, how we're people first. That even if the system is automated and it tells us what the, you know, what it is, it's still trying to get a human being to put the right level of urgency on getting that bid submitted the same day, right? And so no matter what process, no matter what data, no matter what, like that objective of getting it submitted the same day is very rudimentary, right? It is just a simple item. It get the bids done same day. That's all it is. And oh, we got to get this data point and that data point and get an average and set a goal and then roll this out to the team and make sure we track it. Get your bids done the same day. That's all, everybody.
It's not really challenging. And see, I would develop that. And this is great. I love when we have these conversations. Where I would look at that from is if the real goal ultimately, and I loved how you asked that question, if the data has to be accurate, you suss out the goal of we just want to get them out on the same day as much as possible. Then we begin to look at how can we apply our processes to support us in getting the bids out on the same day? And just right, I don't know this business that you're working with the same way that you do, but right off the top of my head, I could imagine a few things. I could imagine having some sort of software that allows us to do conditional logic, where if we're building a bid and we know that there are basically three different basic types of bids, that when you get to a certain process in building this document, it says, which type of project is this? Is it project A, project B, or project C? And if it's project B, I just select the radio button for product B, or C rather, and then click it. And then it takes me to a screen that says, if there are any specific modifications, please add them now, so that we're not going back and rewriting the bid every single time. I would also want that set so that if you have a condition on your bids, like, you know, these price estimates are good for 30 days from the day of this document, that it automatically populated that date. If there was a different signatory on your company's end, that when it came to building out the signature page, that you had a radio button that selected who on your company's end would be the signatory of the document. So that's where I would start, because that would reduce the amount of time that it took people to get the bids out. I might also look at, are we supporting people and having dedicated time where they can say to all other requests and things incoming, look, I got to get these bids out for the end of the day. So that becomes a cultural matter of how we set priorities and how we drive people to achieve results. That's just two things right off the top of my mind based off your excellent question of asking if the data needed to be accurate.
Yeah, I mean, we do 3,000 projects a month. So, I mean, we do a tremendous amount of bidding, and the process is very streamlined. We don't manufacture anything. So we're not selling something that's always the same, or like, you know, product number 1, 2, 3, or 10. It's a customized scope per location. So it's really cool because it requires someone that's thinking on the other end of it, right? Rather than it just, you know, being something that I could give a 12-year-old to do, to just, you know, pick each. It literally we have to take a look at the scope, ensure that the scope is clear. A lot of times the person giving us the scope is the person that's doing the work rather than the client. So the client has a request. They're not sure what's needed. We send an expert out. That expert comes back. We got to review that to ensure that we believe that that is the accurate scope of work. If we do not believe it is, then, you know, dispatch someone else to take a look at it. We've got a couple of different information points that we need. And then all that needs to be processed into an estimate that fits the parameters that we've established with the client. So we establish these service level agreements that, like, this kind of work, this is the quality expectation, this is the, you know, the turnaround, the time, all the different things that go with it. So we're dealing with some pretty sophisticated buyers. Most of our buyers are in charge of $40 or $50 million in budget, if not more. We only work with these super recognizable brands. So like, it's very demanding on our team to make sure that this stuff is there. And so to make it work, our objective really is to make it easier for the proposal to go through. So we established an ongoing pricing guide that some items are similar. When you have a guide that says, hey, as long as your proposal is within this box and your vendor's proposal is inside of this other box, then you have the authority to do it. So our pricing guides are like these dynamic documents that guide our path. But the understanding that every one of them is custom. So how do you provide guidance when you don't have an accurate scope? Well, you establish ranges, and those ranges capture a big percentage of the projects. Then everything that's outside of that goes to a supervisor who has the authority to propose things that's at a higher level. So it's our process really is driven around what each person's permissions are. So you establish, hey, these folks have permission to propose anything that we already have an established pricing range for with the subsequent vendor range. And as long as it's within there, you know, they're green lighted to bid. That allows us to submit bids more quickly. Then if it's outside of that, having it go through a supervisor who understands that they don't leave until all of their open bids are submitted each day, right? And so that means that they spend more of the time processing the more complex ones, which really is not, I mean, I used a lot of words to describe it. I didn't know we would be discussing proposal workflows, but this is what we've done, is established that this falls into a sandbox. I'm going to teach you how to operate in your sandbox, and I'm going to support the heck out of you and give you the tools, resources, and training you need. Then it elevates there, and then we have a set of protocol there to give those folks the permissions they need. And then above that, you know, it goes to someone that's senior. And this process really does work well. But if you look at it, it's not a plug-and-play process. It is a know what's within your set of responsibilities and what's not. And if it's not within yours, if it's outside of what you're capable of, move it to that person as quickly as possible. And it really does work. I mean, that's why we're able to turn bids so darn fast.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. And I think that it's good that we went over some of that, because that does show the value of taking the people first philosophy. Look at everything you did. You you raised a question about the data. Does the data have to be accurate? Which opened a conversation about what was really the goal here. And once you identified the goal was get all the bids out on the same day as much as possible, then that drove a conversation about how to support the people in your organization being able to get those bids out. And as you said, every bid is customized in scope. And even if you were to analyze 3,000 bids, identify five different trends and create five different boilerplates, you're still going to be doing modifications each one of them. And I found that doing bidding and contracting myself in previous business models that you spend most of the time on getting bids out simply by editing the section about what you're actually going to do for them.
Yeah, the scope, right?
Yeah. Oh,
you got it. You got it.
Right. So, what steps do you take overall in building building somebody into a people first leader and make that part of the DNA of the company?
Well, I think the core values play a big role in it. I'm not one of those fluffy guys that likes, yeah, you know, it's, I mean, I don't want to hear that nonsense, but the if you're going to have a, So we have our objectives, right? Our goals, the tangible items. And then our core values are more like the behavioral guidelines for how we're going to behave, for how we're going to act. And so I'll just share with you what ours are. The first one is honor the promise. And so if you make a promise, you're expected to keep it. You know, basic. So go back and look at how, you know, we're people first. Who doesn't want to deal with someone that does what they say they're going to do? But there's the unwritten promise, right? And so if I've hired somebody, it's because they've basically promised me that they're going to make my company stronger and better. Otherwise, why would I hire them? And
right.
And my promise to them is that, hey, your career is safe in my hands. Otherwise, why would they work with me? You know. So the second part is valuing people. You have to value other people. I mean, if you don't recognize that we can't get this done without other people, I mean, it's too simple of a concept. The other one, and I don't have to go through all of them, but we have four of them. But the one that's super important to me, move forward. That's something that we do is we move forward. And so moving forward, of course, training and developing people helps them move forward. Learning from our mistakes, you know, that's moving forward. But the real secret piece of that is forgiveness, right? To forgive one another and to forgive ourselves, because that's really the biggest obstacle to being outperformance is people don't forgive themselves and they don't forgive other people, and they put them in a box, and no one likes being in that box that people put them in. And everybody suffers because of it. So the remedy to all of this is that sounds again very, very simple. But I believe that a manager should only manage people that they like. People, and even though it might sound, you know, a little childlike, if you like somebody, you're willing to put in the time to teach them. You're willing to show them if you had to stay late to teach somebody something and you liked them or didn't like them, you know, which one are you more likely to do and things. So I relate it to like my children, you know, I have to see the good in them. And if the manager does not see the good in their people, it's going to be tough for them to really help that person be successful at the company. If they don't spend the time to teach them and share with them, and then the people won't be better at the folks actually care about them. So if you don't like them, you don't care about them, you might not do it. And then being there to cheer them on, to help them come through, that's that missing piece that really gives a lot of satisfaction. So you have to like the person that you're managing, that you are managing. And if you hit that, then it makes it a lot easier for those other items.
Yeah. You raise a lot of great points with all of that. Now, there's another thing that you shared with me that I'd like to expand upon a bit here. And I think it kind of flows in a way from what you just said. How can focusing on the people who are most often overlooked turn a business into an industry leader?
Well, you know, why are people overlooked? And I think that there's, you know, it's like the superstars get all the attention, right? And who's calling them a superstar? Someone's perceiving them as a superstar. And so it's like, okay, well, they perform well in this and that, but it's an opinion that they're a superstar. And then all of a sudden they get all the things that kind of go along with being a superstar. I think a lot of judgment gets passed on folks for things that are maybe really obvious. You know, like a funny one is if someone thinks that that you have attractive colored eyes, for example, and you say, "Oh, you have great eyes." Like, okay, well, go thank my mom, my dad, because you know I had nothing to do with it. So there's something to that what items that people put value on and aren't exactly the things that make the business go. So when we were reviewing our performers, there was this one lady who nobody on the team liked. Like the managers didn't like her, that she was always criticizing things. And once I started digging through the data, she was the top performer. She was a non-conformer. She didn't their protocol and their, you know, like their kissing up kind of attitude. And right. Here was this lady who they wanted to get rid of, who was actually the top performer. And that's what really kind of opened up my eyes to, like, people put emphasis on their judgments that are outside of the work. So there's certainly a subjective element to people's performance, certainly. And I'm not, do not eliminate it, because if you only go by the numbers, you're going to miss the interconnectivity of the people. But it's objective and subjective. At whatever ratios really matter for your business, I'm not here to recommend what they are for someone, but there must be an element of subjectiveness as well as objectiveness in the review of it. And the things that people don't like, we had somebody that submitted a bid, and the problem, the lady submitted the bid, and it was outside of her parameters, but her parameters weren't really explained to her. So they wanted to go and correct her and say, you never send a bid like this, and it kind of corrected. And I said, I don't know if that's exactly the way we want to respond to it. Well, John, she submitted a bid that she shouldn't have, and she needs to know that's wrong and you know, not do it again. I said, I think you got to go tell her, nice work. I'm so glad that you wanted to get the proposal to the client as quickly as you could. And the guy's face dropped. He was floored. I'm like, you want more of that. We're trying to turn our bids over as quickly as we can. Here's someone that's proactively trying to submit a bid to the point where she submitted it when she shouldn't have. Why shouldn't she have? Well, she doesn't understand the rules. So I don't think that you want to go over there and beat her up over, you know, like criticize what she's doing and all of that, because she's doing the right thing. So how about, hey, I love your initiative. I love that you submitted the bids. I wish that everybody wanted to submit bids like you did. So great work on that. This piece is outside of what your parameters are. Here's what your sandbox is. Anything in here, go ahead and keep doing what you're doing. If it's outside of that, I really want to help you learn how to do more. So anytime you have one that's outside of that, come see me. I'll explain it right away to you so that you can submit it and keep going with this. You know, great work. So you can see, like, if you don't put the person first, if you put your rule first, then, you know, you're showing that the person's in violation. But really that rule is set up to serve our clients well, or it should be. And what she's doing is to better serve our clients. And we should probably not thwart those efforts. We should probably celebrate them. Very simple live issue that happened a month ago where the team wanted to correct her because she made an error, when I wanted it celebrated because she had the right spirit behind what she was doing.
Yeah, you have the spirit, you have the energy, you have the drive. That's something that is a forward moving energy. There's an inertia behind that. So now that you have the movement, it's a lot easier, in my opinion, and you may have a different thought on this. Once you have the movement, you have the inertia of the energy, it's easier to course correct it or turn the steering wheel to drive it to down the road you want it to drive versus actually getting it started in the first place.
You got it.
And you want to talk about overlooked. You made the observation that companies tend to pay a lot of attention to the superstars. And I got to tell you, I was only in corporate scenarios for about 5.5 years. So I don't have the decades that other people may have, but believe me, in those short 5.5 years, I ran across some characters and some stories that, oh my goodness. Now, here's a trend that I kept seeing over and over and over again, from job to job, from department to department, is there were actually two groups of folks, actually, no, I'm going to say three groups of folks that we saw getting inordinate amounts of attention, one of which were the superstars, another of which were the people who slacked off all day, and the third were the people who, even though you outranked them, you had to remember that they were the niece of the CEO's personal assistant, so you had to pay them deference. So I've noticed that those were actually the three that get the attention. So think of those three groups and how the person who's actually, you know, quietly moving ahead, getting results can be easily overlooked.
Right. I mean, if they, it's how do you want to be remembered? And if you look at an operational person, typically you want them, you know, I have a company that cuts the grass and pulls the weeds at my house. And there was a guy he wanted me to, who owned his own business. He used to be my landscaper a long time ago. And there was an area of my grass that he didn't cut. And he kind of left it in overgrew, but I wanted it cut. And so we're having this discussion. And so we got into a little bit of an argument because he didn't want to put his $10,000 machine over there. I'm like, well, it's wet because you never cut it. So the sun doesn't dry it up. And so just hand whip it and, you know, let it dry out so that you can go. And so we get into this little discussion. And so I wasn't going to use him anymore. The next year he comes over to my house and he's just like, you know what, John, I thought a lot about what you said and you're right. I'm sorry. You know, I want to service my clients better. And, you know, I was thinking about my piece of equipment and that rather than thinking of how I could really satisfy it. So kind of going on, and so I had a little bit of hope for the guy. And so he wanted to do the business with me again. And so he's like, you know, the people around here, it's like I can't give away. He was complaining that his business wasn't growing and things. And like, you know, how do you sell to the people that you're already driving to a neighborhood? Why, you know, try to get all the neighbors, you know, whatever. And so he says to me, you know, these people, they don't even want to pay you $25 to cut the grass. And so I looked at him and I'm like, oh, I don't even want to get engaged with this guy. But then I did. I said, you know what, Joe. I said, Joe, look at these homes. Do you think any of these people care about the $25? You know, it's got $9. What you got to understand is that when people hire a landscaper, they want the landscaper to be invisible. They want their grass cut all the time. They want to be no weeds. The phone calls they want to have are around a treatment that's going to make it look prettier, right? Flowers and things like that. But they don't want to call to remind you about the weeds, and they don't want to call to find out when it's being cut. They just want it cut, and they want it weeded. You got to think that is the kind of service that people who have these houses want. It's not about the $25, you know, and it's a frustrating bit because if you don't know what the customer is really looking for, and then you want to be critical of the customer for not buying what you're offering when you're offering too much conversation. They're not looking for a friendship with their landscaper. They're looking for the landscaping to be done and out of mind. That's it. That's the number one objective here. Have my home look beautiful without any of my time being spent on it. And I'm willing to write a check for it. So it might seem like it's harsh, but the idea here is that when you're dealing with something that's just keeping something looking good, that's the job. You're just making sure that it looks good and functions well. Well, those kinds of people should, they're like, they just take care of business. There's no fanfare. There's no, you know, big celebrations and, oh, I got your grass cut and look, I did it on an angle and that's it. Like, there's none of that. And so that personality type that just takes care of business and goes home with no fanfare is phenomenal operationally. Well, we don't tend to take those kinds of folks and put them up on a pedestal. It's usually the funny people, the attractive people, the ones that we like to be around, the ones that make us feel good inside when we're around them. And that's typically coming from that, like kind of cool or fun or attractive folks. So I think that when we're talking about overlooked, like there's great beauty in people that are very determined and stay on track. You know, there's great beauty in people that are really creative. Creatives get a lot of credit for being cool. They're eccentric, they're fun, you know, that kind of thing. But my goodness, if we had a bunch of creatives running a company, you know, there's probably not enough process to keep it profitable.
Yeah, been there and done that with some of my clients where the entire leadership is creative and there's such a lack of process sometimes that it starts to feel in terms of their business trajectory like that movie Groundhog Day over and over again. There's someone I was working with a few years ago, and she was one of those extremely creative types. But when it came down to details and process, she just lost interest in it. I would see her go to the nines designing an incredible presentation, a great webinar, and want to be involved in writing all the awesome emails to drive it, and she'd get huge registrations and lots of people on the line. And then just to give you an example of what would happen next, when it got to the part of utilizing that webinar to drive a sale or create a conversion or get people to take an action, she would, when it came to the part of actually doing the work, which means presenting the webinar, she got so bored with it after 10 minutes. At one point she said, "Okay, Adam, can you do the pitch for me?" Actually said that on a live webinar.
Wow.
Because she got that bored with the actual work and the process of getting the results from it. But her brilliance and passion was in the creative side of it.
Yeah, business leaders also, some of them like this, you know, it's like the salesperson, sales versus operations. The salesperson promises the world, and then the operations person is stuck trying to deliver it, right? And that's tough. Well, a lot of people like the idea of something and it's been solved once they've thought about it and they've shared their two cents. But there's a lot of things that go into bringing that solution to life. And again, that's a very regimented, you know, systematic, methodical thinker that would go through it. And so who picks that person on their team? I do, you know, because I want to win and I need a bunch of people that stay the course. So I think it's just important. So they're overlooked. And then the other thing is that some people are just overlooked socially just for whatever reason. Well, that's what happens to those people that were once overlooked, but now someone's paying attention to them. You know, they get super engaged and very committed, and the loyalty that they have is through the roof. And it's like, why wouldn't you want to tap into it? And like, here's the thing. Why wouldn't you just want to be cool with people? Like what is the cost of that? And you find out that it's nothing other than someone maybe doesn't want to be seen with somebody or want to be around someone or associate with the person. Uh-huh. Like, but is that what you want to load up your team with, people that are that way? You know, it's like, it's backwards. So it's the overlooked ones that end up becoming the super important ones.
Yeah. And you know, I think there is something to status. I have a colleague who had worked with a client. This colleague of mine, he had, at the time, he had a digital marketing agency or something along those lines. It might have been more of a virtual assistance agency. I can't remember because the story is almost 20 years old. But he remembered he had this client that he worked closely with for several years. And then all of a sudden, the client basically started acting like they, the client, were too good to work with someone like him. And just started that process of socially isolating them on the team and hiring other experts just to contradict my colleague so they can make my colleague wrong and everything all the time. And I mean, it was really pathetic in my personal opinion. I had an experience once where I had one client who, you know, taught a very niche subject that some folks might've found a little bit controversial. And then I had this other client that said, "Hey, you know, I noticed you're working with so-and-so over there. And because I saw your webinar where you're talking about some work you did with that other client. Well, you know, I want to refer people to you, but I was wondering if you could like not mention that other client because people might get skittish about it and not want to work with you." And so I went to the person who said that to me and I said, "Okay, so in other words, pretend like I don't even know my actual friends when I'm walking through the hall so that maybe the cool kids will let me sit with them at lunch. I had no time for that in high school either. So you can tell everybody who feels that way that I already don't want to work with them, including anybody who would express a sentiment like that, period. What I was implying was to the person who said, who actually said that to me, who suggested that I deny working with one of my other clients, I said, "When if you feel that way, you can go to hell too."
Yeah.
And what I got next was an apology for them even bringing that up. But I did need to make the point that no, we don't go around and say pick and choose who we'll hang out with based on who other people hang out with, or try and make them accommodate you. If it's a problem for you, then you go somewhere else. But what we also missed in that whole thing is, because you're looking at surface issues, you're hearing something about somebody and deciding that you don't want to be seen as associating with them, or you'll be friends with them, but you don't want to be seen saying hi to them in the hallway or something like that. How is that really creating a people-first culture of any type?
Right. Well, not everybody knows that they should be doing that. Like, when you think about what the environment, like, again, we're people, and people depend on people. And no matter how much we want to think that we're independent, we were created interdependently. We need one another. We need the help, the sacrifice, the warm shoulder, the comforts. I can't, there's a lot of things I can't do. I need other people to do. I don't know how to make clothes, you know,
right?
But I could go make money and buy them from someone that does, you know. And it's like, we need each other. And the ignoring of that, it's like, you know, oh, I want to be independent of what? Like, you want to be above need of another person. Well, I don't know if that's exactly a good trait. You know, like, I don't want to need another person. Why not? I'm afraid of them letting me down. Well, that's what happens. But don't forget, you let people down too.
Yeah.
And we need to forgive one another. We need to give a little bit of grace and allow someone to fail. I've got four kids. The idea that they're perfect is crazy. I want them to fail. I want them to fall down and pick themselves up. If they go through all their teenage years and never falter, and then they become adults, how are they going to know how to pick themselves up? Because heartbreak is sure to find them. It's just part of life. Other setbacks are going to be there. People are going to mistreat them and all of that. And they have to be strong enough to handle it. And I think it's my job to make sure, it's a responsibility to do it. But actually, it's more like a privilege. Like, I'm going to do something that's going to be meaningful for my kids. And you know what? It's meaningful to me too, because I might have to over-discipline in some areas in order for them to learn something. But I'm also able to soften the blow. If the person knows what they did is wrong, you don't have to spend much time explaining to them that it's wrong, because they already know it. It's the ones that they don't know is wrong. I have my two eldest, one does her homework like a machine, and the other one needs... If she doesn't need 10 reminders, she doesn't need any, right? Constantly have the reminder. What happens to my influence of my 15-year-old if I keep reminding her to go do her homework when she always does her homework? So I could check the box off that says, well, Dad was making sure that homework was done, and that would be fine. But from her point of view, my skills as an advisor go way down, because I sound like a blowhard that keeps saying things that are unnecessary. Now, if you've got children, and the idea that you love your child so much, you want nothing but good for them, you'd be there for them no matter what situation came about, for them to think that you're a blowhard and would quickly dismiss your opinion, it could be one of the worst things that you could do for a child. So, yeah, I'm not going to keep reminding both of my kids to do their homework. I'm only going to remind them when it needs the reminder. And the other one, I'm going to say, how are things going? I'm going to talk to her differently. I'm going to treat her individually. And so, again, these are just simple things that people miss on, because they're not thinking about the other person. They're thinking about themselves and saying, oh, I want to make sure I check the box that says I was a good dad and following up on homework.
Yeah. I find that I find that pretty interesting, and makes me think of stories I hear about folks in their childhoods, especially of, and some of that even translates into the adult world. A colleague of mine told me about an experience that she had with one of her clients, where sometimes one of her clients would just get stuck on something and would continually nag her about one little thing. And usually it was actually a very minor thing. Meanwhile, she needed important information from her clients to do the work that she was being paid to do for them. And she would ask totally legitimate questions. And the client would say things like, "Well, you know, I don't really have time for this." And for the 15th time. And she revealed to me that whenever her clients started nagging her about things, she would intentionally keep putting it off just to drive the client crazy. This is somebody who was paying her. But she did it because she wanted to amplify that by way of showing them that by fixating on some small thing, it was actually creating the exact opposite of what they were looking for. The client wasn't hearing the message that by harping on these things, it was actually alienating people, rather than taking the approach of, this thing that I need is actually important because it impacts Y. And if we don't get X done, Z won't happen. There wasn't any of that. It was just a bunch of nagging, like she was too dumb to figure out that something actually needed done. And at one point, the client actually nagged her about it 5 times in 1 hour, and it wasn't even an urgent thing. This is where, when I think of people first, I think of when we create process flows, going back to what we were discussing earlier, process flows, when we set up projects and softwares like Teamwork and things like that, and we create dependencies or next steps. We need to think about that when we create things for people in our organizations to do, and when we ask people to do things for us, give assignments and things like that, is one thing that we have found, and I've covered this in my book actually, is if you want somebody to actually meet the deadline, to be motivated to meet the deadline, and to recognize the importance, is to show them the impact that getting that done will have. So John, you do X, that means that Clara will be able to pick that up and do Y, which is her assignment. And Glenn, if you don't deliver that project, you don't deliver that analysis, then Suzanne is not going to be able to create the presentation that we need to face the client on Friday as part of the bid on the $250,000 project. So when people see that their completion of work or not has a direct tangible impact on other things down the line, that can be a great motivator, because people don't want to be seen, generally speaking, as letting others down. But if you just harp on somebody over and over again, and you do it so much, you end up doing it 5 times in 1 hour, and there's no justification or reason why, then it's like, hey, you know what? I'm going to keep not doing it just to see how crazy I'll drive them.
Sanity is a finite resource.
Yeah. So that's part of my take on that. Now, one other thing that we wanted to cover in our few minutes left here is just in general, to bring this all together. John, having read your story and having seen some of the work you do, I've noticed the importance of living a principled life. And how, for you, has living a principled life made you a better leader?
Well, I believe in God, and if you believe in God, then you know your place is below him, right? And so,
yeah.
And we're amongst all the other people. And if I believe that we're all, you know, God's children. And so it's kind of tough for me to look at somebody else and with absolute disgust, knowing that he or she is important to my maker. So I think that there's that humility or and respect for another person, that human dignity is just like, I don't have to like what you do. And I don't have to trust you, but I do have to respect that you have human dignity, that just by being a person, that, you know, that there's value to you, regardless of how I feel about your decision and what you do and all of that. And so that, I think that part keeps me humble, right? And then the other part to that is a good man, the Bible describes a good man as being somebody that is slow to anger and quick to forgive. And if we think about a man that's quick to anger and quick to forgive, you know, they kind of, they're erratic a little bit. You know, you never know what you're going to get. And then if they're quick to anger and slow to forgive, I mean, those are brooders. Nobody says, let me go deal with that guy. You know, and so I think that when people that are slow to anger and slow to forgive, they're grudge holders. So, I mean, if we just do that simple examination, man, I'd like to be that guy that's slow to anger and quick to forgive and kind of live accordingly. And if I'm that way, and happy, even when difficult times come my way, and I'm able to keep my mind about me and not act out of character or not very often out of character, I think that's a kind of a good thing, especially for other men and young men to see and kind of work on themselves. So I think a lot of the problems in the world get resolved as men are able to be men, and, you know, rather than kind of being taught always to be girls. It's like everything, you know, like there are differences to us, and I don't mean it in any political way. I mean it like there's differences, and we got different hormones and different things that make us okay. And man, being a guy is there's a lot of responsibility that comes with being a man, and I like right. it. I like that responsibility. I like having to share it, and I'm hoping that I can do good for other people, just like so many have done good for me.
Yeah. And, you know, we speak about slow to anger, quick to forgive, quick to anger, slow to forgive. I've always wondered if some of that comes from conditioning that some folks receive as children. For example, if you make a mistake as a child, how is that handled? Do you have to go through hours and hours of process where you're nagged and prodded and browbeaten until you are able to explain in complete sentences how you were bad and you were wrong and you were so sorry and you'll never ever do it again? And after some time, you begin to reject the idea of feedback, because the way feedback has been dealt with you up until now is it becomes a form of torture. So, and besides, that whole thing of, I'm really, really sorry and I'll never do it again. How do you know you won't do it again? That's a question I love to ask especially when I hear parents of children say, and yes, I got little Susie to say that she was sorry and should never do it again. I said, really? Susie's never going to do it again? Really?
I met Susie.
Yeah.
I think she's going to do it again.
Exactly. Exactly. So when we get the conditioning that anytime we make any common mistake, that there has to be a process and we have to basically eviscerate ourselves to prove how sorry we are, then since we were never given forgiveness, why should we forgive others? They should have to explain to us and beg our forgiveness and show us that they'll never do it again. Isn't that fair?
I think the most underused line is knock it off, and its cousin, get out of here with that nonsense.
Yeah.
we need to hear this more often, a little less coddling, especially when it comes from someone that loves us, that's going to, you know, try to not overstep it, but give us the firm response that we need in order to keep doing, like, you don't do that. It's like teaching boys, we don't hit girls, right? We don't hit girls. Yeah. I don't care what the situation, we don't hit girls. Oh, well, she did that. We don't hit girls. You're a boy. We don't hit girls, right? Like we're just firm on that, right? We're just firm. We don't do the, there's certain things we just don't do. Don't go doing this. You can do a lot of things. You can make a lot of mistakes. We don't make this mistake. Again, it goes back to, you know, just what you do. Even disciplining a child. I mean, I've seen heavy discipline, you know, heavy-handed discipline hey, you know, people do what they do. But you don't hit a kid in the face, you know? You don't, like, right. You don't do things that start to disrespect a person. Sometimes, you know, I know that it helped when I got cracked quite a number of times. It helped me. It was good to know that I grew up in a very, very rough neighborhood, very rough neighborhood. And, the worst area, I went to school in the worst area in Chicago, the worst area. And I learned real quick, you just keep your mouth shut, you know? You got something to say, to get power, you know? And so you just learn things by having these controls put in on you. Now, those weren't ones that I desired. I didn't say, hey, let me go, you know, go this way. But you learn the rules of the game, and then you play accordingly. And that discipline, that obedience to that situation, which was unwritten, there's obedience to, okay, the police or the teachers or the dean or whatever the case is. But to a peer, well, if the guy can knock your head off, probably don't want to get smart-lipped with them, you know?
Right.
He might knock your head off. So I think there's some good, you know, good self-control that gets learned through that. And so, again, we're people first. Let's recognize that people are struggling. Nobody wants to do a bad job. Nobody. You know, if they're doing something that they don't, that is really, really bad, chances are they're in a pretty bad position on something. You know, take the time to investigate. Don't put them in a box. Try to categorize them, and then that categorization is really a diminishing of them. Like, you are just a guy that doesn't follow the rules, or you're just something. You know, we want to get away from the word just and recognize that, hey, people are a lot more things than just someone who made a mistake on that project, and a lot of things might have been factoring in. So maybe take a couple minutes to go see what's going on in their world before you go handing out judgment and discipline and all that. Get to [S2] Right. [S1] The bottom of it. Make sure what you're doing is right. You know, I use the example, if I ran into a store like Walgreens or CVS and I ran out of the store without paying for something, you know, am I a thief? Well, yeah, he took something that didn't get, you know, I didn't pay for. If I ran in to grab bandage because somebody outside had been shot and I didn't wait in line to buy the stuff, and I ran out there, yeah, I still stole. It's not exactly the same thing as I'm going to take something that's yours for my own personal use.
And it doesn't mean you're stealing, because if somebody's shot and they need a bandage, there's nothing that said you weren't going to pay for those band-aids, but there wasn't time to stand in line to pay for them while you have a guy with a gusher out in a parking lot. Investigating the situation concludes, yeah, John had a guy who was shot. He ran in and grabbed some band-aids. So let's let him treat the person who got shot and assume, until shown otherwise, that he's going to come in and pay for the Band-Aids and say, hey, the guy was shot. I need to give him emergency first aid. Now, how do I pay for these Band-Aids?
Exactly. So you got it. So that's the whole idea here, is simply, let's be a little slow. Before we go judging somebody as what they're doing is wrong, why don't we, you know, ask a couple of questions just to make sure we're not making assumptions. Because once people make those assumptions, then they try to defend those assumptions, and they start justifying these poor decisions and blah, blah, blah. But you want to go call the police on the guy that's saving the guy that got shot? Come on. Get out of here.
Yeah.
Get out of here with that nonsense.
I know. I was on the receiving end of that once when I was trying to help somebody in distress, and some bellhop at some hotel tried to get in my way. And yeah. I was dealing with somebody who was actually in a moment of distress, and this bellhop tried to enforce some policy on me. And I actually looked at the guy and I said, either help me or get the fuck out of my way.
Wow.
And his choice was to get security to have me evicted from the property. But then I actually spoke with a security guy, and they said to the bellhop, no, this person was actually a hero here trying to help this person. So in the future, maybe investigate the situation before making assumptions.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, I can't get into the stress we were dealing with. Let's just say it wasn't far removed from somebody being shot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So we're right here near the top of the hour, and and before we go here, you have a little something for our listeners.
Well, we're always looking to help companies that are looking to grow and that maybe need some capital and some other pieces. So if there are companies that are out there that know they can be accomplishing more, just need a little bit of help along the way, we're happy to help take a look at it. So if people want to reach out to me, they can find me at, they can email me, is probably the best way, at John at johnfairclough.com. This J-O-H-N, F as in Frank, or as I like to say, fantastic, AIRCLOUGH.com.
Perfect, perfect. And you also wanted to, you also, I believe you had some gifts for our folks.
Those are supposed to be surprises.
Oh, surprises. Yes, yes, yes. I'll share a few here. If our listeners go to Resicon Online, yeah, Ash, I'm sorry, that's, yeah, Resicom, R-E-S-I-C-O-M, online.com/BCR. John has a few great gifts for you, so just go ahead and check that out, resicomonline.com/BCR, and those will be some great things that will help you move forward even further, building on the topic of putting people first. So, John Fairclough, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been an honor and an education.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. And we trust that you've enjoyed today's episode of Business Creators Radio Show. Please check out our previous and upcoming episodes on our website at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. And while you're there, be sure to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. Until next time, have a great day. Take care.